This file and its contents are copyrighted by aboutfacts.net. All rights are reserved.
Our guest today is Richard Cook, a former NASA analyst, one of the key figures in the Challenger investigation, and the author of the popular book, Challenger Revealed. Hello, Mr. Cook. May I call you Richard? You can call me Ken.
Yes, that's fine.
Okay. Would you tell my readers about your background with NASA?
Well, I was a professional federal government analyst. I came to work for the federal government in 1970. I worked originally at the U.S. Civil Service Commission, and then I went on from there to work at the Food and Drug Administration and then the Jimmy Carter White House. And I was there to the end of the Carter administration and then stayed on for a year when the Reagan administration came in working in the consumer affairs area. I left NASA for, left the government actually for a couple of years, and then came back into the government in the summer of 1985, and I was hired at NASA at that time as a resource analyst for the solid rocket boosters and the external tank. And so I was working in NASA for about 6 months in the comptroller's office at NASA headquarters in Washington when the Challenger disaster took place.
Tell us a little bit about your book and where it can be purchased.
Well, the book is called Challenger Revealed. The subtitle is How the Reagan Administration Caused the Greatest Tragedy of the Space Age. It's a hardcover book. It's published by Thunder's Mouth Press, and it's available in bookstores, or it can be ordered through all of the major online publishers.
Mm. Before we get into the disaster, I'd like to ask you a few things first. I've always felt that the space shuttle was designed in such a way that it was far too dangerous for the astronauts and far too expensive to operate. For one thing, it doesn't even have ejection seats for low altitude escape. What do you think about the shuttle?
Well, the shuttle, as it was initially designed, was a compromise vehicle that had a lot of features that were built into it to make it a military launch vehicle. This went back to the Nixon administration. The original space shuttle that was conceived of by the NASA engineers was a smaller vehicle. It would have been much safer, and it would have been really the first step toward an eventual return to the moon. But the way that the Nixon administration designed it, it was really a vehicle that was going to be very large, very heavy, that was to be used for military purposes as well as civilian space purposes. And so that was what accounted for a lot of the compromise features in it that made it as big and as unwieldy as it was, including the a tile system that they used on the bottom of the shuttle that was been problematic ever since it was first thought of. So the space shuttle was overbuilt, and it was overbuilt for purposes of launching military missions as well as civilian missions.
Hmm. Why was the design that had essentially two rockets strapped to it accepted over the one that had a vehicle mounted on the tip of a standard rocket?
Well, the shuttle was something that they wanted to reuse. The whole purpose of having a airplane-type design was to be able to use it over and over again in and out of low Earth orbit. Now, the old capsules that were used in the Mercury and the Gemini and the Apollo programs were really built for much longer distance, you know, for travel to the moon eventually. It was a lunar program from the very beginning. And so these were one-time capsules that were used for unique missions. But with the shuttle, they wanted what they called a space truck, and they wanted to be able to use it over and over again for every type of mission. Mm-hmm. The trouble is that it was built too big and too heavy to be truly safe.
Right. So you feel that the real reason for the shuttle was military weapons testing, huh?
Well, the military at that time was using it primarily, or was going to use it primarily for satellite launch. And these military spy satellites that they put up are really enormous. They're much bigger than your typical communication satellite that, you know, you put up for telephone or weather observation or that sort of thing. in order to launch these huge military satellites, they needed a tremendous amount of booster thrust. The unmanned rockets that they were using gave that thrust, but NASA, in order to get the shuttle approved by Congress, had to get the military on board. And so the way they did this was by promising a thrust in a manned vehicle that was equivalent to the unmanned.
Uh-huh.
And that's what made it really too heavy and unsafe.
Is the shuttle capable of better performance than we've been led to believe? For example, does it have a greater range than we've been told?
Not really. The shuttle can't go much past the 1 to 200 nautical mile range. It's really a low Earth orbit vehicle. And that limits its use to the kind of environments that you use for low-orbiting satellites or the International Space Station. The shuttle can't even deliver a geosynchronous satellite to high Earth orbit. You need booster rockets fired out of the shuttle in order to do that, and those produce their own safety problems. All of this being done in a manned vehicle makes the shuttle extremely expensive even to launch one time, and extremely unsafe because, as you know, right now, whenever a space shuttle is launched to go to the International Space Station, the number one issue is whether they'll even come back, whether it's safe even to get into orbit and back again.
The Challenger was a terrible disaster that many people say could have been avoided. Please tell us what caused it and what transpired the day that the Challenger launch was authorized.
Well, the cause of the Challenger disaster is very complex. Basically, because the shuttle is as complex and potentially unsafe as it is, you need to take just extraordinary precautions every time the shuttle is sent up. But there were a number of hardware features on the shuttle that were not performing the way they were supposed to, or the way that NASA really should have had them perform. The biggest problem at the time, at least the one that was most visible, was with the main engines, because the main engines had a lot of different problems that were causing them, for example, to shut down in flight. There was one instance where one engine was lost, another engine might have shut down, and a catastrophic accident occurred then. But they were able to work around that. But there were major problems in the main engines that NASA was still working on, even as they were increasing their flight rate back in 1985, 1986. The other major problems had to do with the tile system, because the tiles always were very sensitive. And the type of accident that destroyed Columbia in 2003 was foreseen even before the shuttle ever flew, when they were trying to get the tile system right. There was always the problem of the debris falling from the external tank. Again, that contributed to the Columbia disaster. And then there were these problems going on with the solid rocket boosters of various types. And the main problem with the solid rocket boosters was the fact that the seals in the separated the segments of the solid rocket boosters were constantly showing signs of heat distress or erosion, because flames were leaking through the interior of the solid rocket boosters and getting into the joints that that held the segments together. And of course, these joints were sealed with O-rings and a kind of thermal protective putty that was also not performing properly and was being compromised. So NASA knew about all of these things. But they just were not able to stop at any given point and fix them. But again, it goes back to the fact that the shuttle itself is so sensitive, so complex, and has so many potential problems that you just got to be incredibly cautious and careful every time you launch the shuttle, which of course limits the number of times you can launch it, mm-hmm. and adds to the cost of launching it. So there's a tremendous potential at any given time of compromising safety. And up until the Challenger disaster, they were cutting so many corners that they lost it. And the same thing happened with Columbia. They were continuing to cut corners at that time, and they lost another one.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the specific flaw in the O-ring joints, one of the things that I document in my book is that even though the engineers at Thiokol knew about these problems for well over a year and knew that cold temperatures tremendously aggravated the problem, NASA was not willing to stop flights. In fact, the engineers at Thiokol who knew about the cold temperature problems were told specifically by officials at the Marshall Space Flight Center not to mention these in flight readiness reviews because they didn't want any interference with the military missions that were planned to be launched out of Edwards Air Force Base in California.
Wow.
So I consider that to be one of the primary causes of the Challenger disaster.
Why are O-rings used in a shuttle? Isn't there any other method that could be used as a seal that would be more reliable?
Well, the problem with the seal is that it moves. It's flexible.
Well, I was going to ask you about that later, yeah.
Yeah, and that's going to be the case in any rocket that's built with joints. And that, of course, goes back to the original design. And the original design with the jointed segments was put into place because it was the only way that they could reuse the rockets. Each of those rocket segments was designed to be used multiple times, and so the only way to transport something that big, once it came down in the ocean and get it back to the factory to have the fuel put back in it, was by breaking it down into segments. So they had that problem from the very start. Now, when you have a rocket with segments, as I said, the segments are always going to move. When ignition occurs, that whole thing just fills up kind of like a balloon. And so you've got to have something able to move within the gap in order to fill the gap, and that's why they chose the O-rings for that purpose. Now, even before the shuttle ever flew, they were told by the manufacturer of the O-rings that the product was not meant to be used in that manner. An O-ring is a pressure seal. It does have to move slightly to fill a gap, but to move in the directions that these O-rings were supposed to be moving within the joint was viewed initially as unsafe. And so that's another reason why this was such a problem for them, because they had a design issue that they never were able to overcome. So when they realized that the redundancy had been lost with the second O-ring, because of the way that the segments of the rocket spread, they really didn't put anything in place to counter that. Now, after the Challenger disaster, they came up with a new design that has a third O-ring and a different type of putty. So even today, they're still flying with a joint that has a moving O-ring within it, although now they have triple redundancy. And, of course, since the Challenger disaster, they've had no more catastrophes due to the solid rocket boosters. But this is a feature that's always existed on segmented solid rockets, even before Challenger back in the 60s and early 70s. They were flying solid rockets to launch satellites with a O-ring joint that had the O-rings moving within the joint, and they did see signs at times of heat distress on those O-rings. So no matter how you do it, if you're going to have a jointed rocket using solid fuel, you're going to have something like O-rings, and you're going to have the possibility of an O-ring leak. So that's just another reason why you've got to be tremendously cautious and conservative whenever you launch any of these things, especially in a manned environment.
The Challenger was destroyed only 73 seconds into its flight. Would an ejection system have saved any lives in this case?
Well, I think probably my contention at the time, based upon what I felt was pretty solid information from engineers, was that yes, it probably could have. But the problem with that was that the orbiter, you know, the winged airplane that is the vehicle that the crew is flying on, has a double-decker seat. Now, in the original design for the space shuttle, when they flew the first two missions, I think it was actually the first four missions, the four experimental missions, they did have an ejection seat on it. And the ejection seat or ejection capsule was to allow the two astronauts, the pilot and the commander, to eject. but they never were able to figure out any way to create an ejection capsule that would be big enough and safe enough to allow the entire crew to eject if you had more than two astronauts, because you've got a second deck, a lower deck, with the mission specialists on it. And when they took out, when they went to their fifth mission and they started to fly more than two astronauts, they took out that feature. Also, in order to have an ejection system, you need a sensor system that will tell you immediately if an O-ring has burned through. They did not have this on the Challenger, and so the astronauts had no idea until it blew up that anything was even wrong, although, as you know, looking at the photographs of the launch, you could see the flame leaks coming out of the side of the of the Challenger within milliseconds of ignition. So you would need a sensor system to alert them, and then you would need a capsule to be able to eject them at that point before the vehicle was going too fast. Now, some people have said that the speed, given the design of the orbiter, would have precluded any type of ejection system. But again, I think that's because you've got such a large crew capsule to accommodate more than two astronauts.
The Rogers Commission found that the accident was the fault of NASA. Do you think that this was a cover-up to protect the president?
Well, yes, I do. And I think that when I went through all of the different steps of what happened during the days and the night before the launch, I do believe that it was a cover-up that the commission itself was a part of to prevent any hint that orders from the White House to launch Challenger in time for the State of the Union address or for the publicity with the Teach from Space program had a part in the launch decision. But I concluded, and I think on the basis of one eyewitness to the decision, as well as all of the circumstantial evidence, that the there was in fact a cover-up of White House pressure to launch.
Could you tell us what documents you turned over to the New York Times and what they proved?
Well, there were a whole series of papers that had been written prior to the Challenger disaster that documented the history of the O-ring problems. There was a waiver that was granted back in 1983, almost 3 years before the disaster, that demonstrated that NASA was aware that because of the way the O-ring joints bulged at liftoff, it's called joint rotation, the redundancy of the dual O-ring system had been compromised. And so some of the papers had to do with documenting that. And this was a very significant set of documents that came up repeatedly in the commission hearings, including some of the closed hearings, which demonstrated that NASA knew that the system was no longer redundant. And so if you had a problem with the primary O-ring at liftoff, you very well could destroy the whole system, which is what happened. So that was a very key document. The engineer who gave me that document called it the death document because it described exactly how the Challenger disaster occurred. In addition to that, there were reports of concern about the O-rings that had gone to various meetings within the Office of Space Flight at NASA over the last 2 to 3 years. There was a document that showed O-ring problems as being a major agenda item for a meeting with James Beggs, the administrator of NASA. It was part of a NASA budget package. And then there were my own memos that I wrote, one of them written in July of 1985, which documented the concerns of the solid rocket booster engineers that there was a potential catastrophic problem with the O-ring joints. And then I wrote an additional memo after the disaster where I concluded that the accident was likely a preventable accident.
Well, first, I'd like to say that it took great courage to do what you did. Did you ever regret this decision in later years?
No, I never regretted the decision. I felt that I did what I had to do at the time. There was a cover-up going on in NASA. Everyone was expected to keep their mouth shut. The commission itself was kind of tiptoeing around the issue, and the commission was beginning to talk to NASA about some of these things, but it was fairly clear that the commission was mainly doing a public relations job that eventually was going to not really result in any real public disclosure of what the actual problems were. And so I made a decision at the time to disrupt the cover-up and to give the press the documents that would prove that NASA knew what the problem had been. And even though from that point on, I left NASA just a few days after my commission testimony. Mm-hmm. And I spent the next 21 years working in the U.S. Treasury Department doing other kinds of work. And even though the impact on my career was largely negative, I felt I did what I had to do as a public servant.
Right. Oh, that was something. Some people have called the shuttle a disaster waiting to happen. Do you agree with this statement?
Yes, I do. And the reason I do is that the decision to continue to fly, and the term used in NASA when you knew you had a problem and you weren't going to stop and fix it, was fly as is. And that's a term that I use in a number of places in my book. The determination by NASA to fly as is with the O-ring problems, and it may have been a similar case with some of the other problems, such as the main engines, as I mentioned earlier, but that decision was a decision to fly with the risk that they knew was there. And so, yeah, from that standpoint, it was a preventable accident. It should not have happened.
Is it true that the launch of Challenger was delayed so that then Vice President Bush could watch?
No, I don't believe it was. I read that all of that documentation very carefully. Vice President Bush was actually scheduled to come down to the Kennedy Space Center and witness the launch the Sunday before the actual Challenger launch took place, which was on a Tuesday. And the launch on that day, Sunday, was canceled by Acting Administrator William Graham, even though Bush was supposed to attend. So there was no delay that I was aware of or could find in the documentation because of Bush's presence. It was almost the other way around. The actual launch day that had been scheduled, which was that Sunday, was a perfect day for launch. And there was, it was very suspicious to me all the way around why Graham actually canceled the launch on that day. And it was also viewed as unusual by some of the other people who were at Kennedy observing events. In fact, astronaut John Young asked, you know, who made the stupid decision to cancel that day, because in normal circumstances, even if they got an unfavorable weather report, they would still board the astronauts on board and just wait for a break in the weather and then take advantage of that and go ahead and launch, but they didn't do that. Now, I traced through that whole decision in my book and reached a conclusion that because of a rather obscure launch rule having to do with how many days in a row you can tank the liquid oxygen and hydrogen for the external tank, Graham or whoever made that decision seemed to feel they would have better launch opportunities between that day and the day of the President's State of the Union speech, which was Tuesday, if they postponed that Sunday launch date. Now, that is all in my book, and it's in, you know, some fairly complex technical language, but that was the level at which the NASA officials were working, and I believe that was why the decision was made.
Challenger had a lot of problems before takeoff that delayed it several times, such as problems with the hatch. A micro switch indicated it was open when it wasn't, and a strip bolt caused another problem. Was there any reason for these problems, such as lax maintenance or insufficient device checks?
Well, it's very hard to trace the exact causes. You know, some of these hardware issues that had affected previous shuttle launches were very complex, and some of them were traced back to error on the part of the people who were doing the maintenance. Some of it was traceable back to worker fatigue because of the tremendously complex and ambitious launch schedule that they were under. So there were a lot of things like that. But the main reason that the Challenger launch was delayed in the first place was because the previous mission of Columbia was delayed in landing at the Kennedy Space Center. Now, I happened to be down at the Kennedy Space Center on January 16th and 17th of 1985, and I was going to witness the landing of Columbia there at the landing strip, but it was waved off because of unsettled weather. And so they had to send Columbia back out to California to land at Edwards. But in order to launch Challenger, which was on the launch pad at the time, they needed to cannibalize parts from Columbia. So what that meant was they had to pull the parts out of Columbia, fly them across country to Kennedy, and install them on Challenger. Now, NASA never told the public about this. They covered up the fact that they had to do this because it was embarrassing. What they told the press was that this was potential bad weather at the shuttle landing strips in Africa or something like that, which was absurd because the real delays came because of the tight launch schedule and the need to get the spare parts off of Columbia. So this had already happened and caused the delay of Challenger going into the weekend before the actual disaster took place. And then, as I say, the postponement on Sunday came because of a misjudgment, I believe, by the launch officials at that time. That took you down then to Monday, where the hatch got stuck and you stripped the bolt. And I have never seen a truly satisfactory explanation for how all that happened, but when you're dealing with that kind of very complex hardware and it doesn't work right the first time, it's just like, you know, fixing your car. If the bolt doesn't come out, then you're going to have to work on it. And by the time they were ready to get it fixed, it was too late in the launch window for that day to launch. So they just said, well, okay, everybody go back to their quarters. We'll try again tomorrow morning. The problem with the next day was that they had this terrible cold front blowing in from the continental air mass that was going to freeze everything up. And so they immediately went into kind of a panic mode to try to get themselves situated so they could go ahead and launch on Tuesday, even though this cold temperature front was moving in and the engineers were starting to be very, very upset about what that could do, not just to the O-rings, but also to creating ice on the launch pad. So you had a whole series of circumstances there. But again, if you were exercising due caution with your hardware and with your launch schedule, all of this stuff you could accommodate. The fact was they were under tremendous pressure, and the commission never explained where this pressure came from. And I think I've demonstrated in my book that it came from the White House.
Wow. You mean to say they didn't have any spare parts available?
This was a big problem with the shuttle orbiters. They were short on spare parts. And if you read, for example, the report that was done after the commission by the House Science and Technology Committee, and get into some of these hardware issues, you know, we used the phrase, the long pole in the tent, as to what was holding up the program, and spare parts were a long pole in the tent. There are so many different parts, including electrical generation units, small thruster rockets that are used to maneuver the vehicle around in space, computer parts, all of these things, just thousands and thousands of parts. And every time you launched a shuttle, you had a shortage of parts, and so they had to take some parts out of the other orbiters that had just flown and put it into the current orbiter.
Oh my
and
goodness.
This was what actually caused the initial delay in the Challenger launch.
Well, I got to tell you, I never knew that one. Is it true that minimum temperatures for a safe launch of the shuttle was 31 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 1 centigrade, and yet the minimum temperature recommended by some Morton Thiokol engineers that were responsible for the external fuel tank stated that the temperature should be above 53 degrees Fahrenheit and 12 degrees centigrade for the O-rings to seal properly? Why was there this discrepancy?
Well, what you say is exactly true in terms of what actually happened at the Kennedy Space Center. The entire shuttle system had a minimum launch temperature of around 30 to 31 degrees. That means you weren't supposed to launch below that air temperature. There were other instrumentation packages on the shuttle that had their own temperature limitations, and very few people realized that the night before the launch, NASA wrote a number of waivers to these temperature constraints in order to allow the vehicle to be launched, even without reference to the O-rings themselves. Again, all of these are in my book. Now, the reason that the 53-degree temperature constraint came into play was that back in January of 1985, NASA had launched the space shuttle from Florida, and it was during another cold spell. It was what they called at that time the cold snap of the century, which, of course, it was repeated a year later with Challenger. But way back then, January of 1985, they'd launched in cold temperatures, and they had a record number of four O-rings showing heat distress. And coming out of that mission, Thiokol put together a series of laboratory tests of the O-rings to show, that demonstrated that even below a temperature of 75 degrees Fahrenheit, the O-rings began to show signs that they were getting stiff and could not fully perform up to the level that they needed to perform to fill the extrusion gaps, which they were called, in the solid rocket boosters. So the temperature at the launch of the shuttle in January of 85, and this was a temperature not of the air temperature, but of the calculated joint temperature of the solid rocket booster O-ring joints, was 53 degrees. And because they saw so much heat distress at 53 degrees, and because their lab tests were starting to tell them that anything below 75 degrees could potentially compromise the O-ring joints, when the Challenger launch came up in January of 1986, and the engineers began to hear about the cold wave that was moving into Florida, they met together, just the engineers, and they said, well, what do we think a safe launch temperature would be? And the conclusion was that we should launch only at a higher temperature than what we saw a year ago, and that was a calculated joint temperature of 53 degrees. So in absence of any other number, that was the number that the engineers of Thiokol picked as a safe launch temperature. And, of course, to NASA, this was very upsetting because there's a big difference between 53 degrees, as you say, and 31 degrees. And so this was kind of what they used to challenge Thiokol with, even though they themselves knew that these temperature problems had existed and were a major issue. Now, Alan McConnell, who was the chief managing engineer of Thiokol at the Kennedy Space Center, after that long teleconference the night before the disaster, when the Thiokol executives had backed down under NASA pressure and voted 4-0 to agree to the launch, Alan McDonald testified before the Presidential Commission that he said to NASA at the Kennedy Space Center, if anything happens to this vehicle, I would not want to be the one to have to sit there before a board of inquiry and explain why they launched a vehicle that was only qualified down to 31 degrees. So what McDonald was referring to was the air temperature where NASA was planning, given the weather forecast, to launch at sub-freezing temperatures that morning or the following morning. So he was referring to the 31-degree constraint. But whether you look at that or whether you look at the 53-degree constraint coming from the engineers, everybody at Thiokol was saying, basically, it's too cold to launch Challenger. Don't do it. Except for the four managers at Thiokol who voted to approve the launch after NASA pressured them.
Mm. Do you think that O-rings were the cause of any other shuttle disasters or near disasters?
No. Let me take that back. You say near disasters. There were incidents before Challenger where you had distress that could have affected the vehicle, but didn't. Again, the January 1985 launch had four O-rings that were eroded by flames that quite possibly could have caused a disaster if it had been worse, but it did not. There was also an incident where the lining on the nozzle of a solid rocket booster was almost burned all the way through because of impurities in the nozzle lining, and that was judged to be seconds away from disaster by the NASA officials who examined it afterwards, the NASA and the contractor officials who examined it afterwards. So the O-rings had shown signs of potentially catastrophic problems up until the Challenger disaster, but they did not cause the disaster, till Challenger. And then the other catastrophic event, which was the 2003 destruction of Columbia, was not due to a O-ring problem or a solid rocket booster problem. That was due to a burn-through of the fuselage that occurred after the heat-resistant tiles were damaged.
Mm. Is it strange that the external fuel tanks survived the Challenger destruction while the shuttle didn't?
Oh, you mean the solid rocket boosters?
Yeah.
Because the external tank was the part that initially broke up, because the boosters, when they broke loose of the configuration, they were attached by struts to the external tank, and they swung around, and the tank came apart, and that was the huge fireball that you saw in the photographs. Then the shuttle itself, the vehicle, broke up into pieces, but the crew cabin came out of it intact, and the crew cabin containing the members of the crew fell all the way to the surface of the ocean and shattered at that point. Now, the solid rocket boosters themselves did continue in flight until they were blown up by the person who was in charge of range safety.
Ah. Well, we've been talking about ejection seats on the shuttle, and basically, I was wondering, why couldn't they have designed, say, a detachable crew cabin that would have came down like with maybe large parachutes?
Some people say they could have and should have. That's a controversial point, but there were people who were saying that that's what they should have designed into it. And when afterwards the shuttle was had a summary design done to it after the Challenger disaster, they put in place this mechanism where the astronauts would slide down along a pole and parachute out individually. But it was always controversial as to whether something the size of the shuttle orbiter, whether you could have the enormous crew cabin that they do have eject intact, even though with the Challenger disaster itself, it did come out in a unit. Mm-hmm. But it's a very controversial point. The Challenger, the space shuttle initially, was the only space vehicle ever designed that did not have a primary ejection capability from the launch pad in the early stages of the launch.
Mm. The Challenger disaster was in 1986. Is the space shuttle any safer today than it was then?
Well, the space shuttle is, and always has been, extremely complex, very hazardous vehicle to operate. It still has features that are very, very dangerous, and the main one is the tile system underneath the vehicle that is to protect the orbiter when it comes back into space. Even to this day, NASA does not feel that they have a completely safe vehicle to work with, and I believe this is one of the reasons that the space shuttle is being phased out. The space shuttle is not scheduled to fly after the year 2010.
Mm-hmm. Please correct me if I am wrong, but most of the fuel the shuttle uses is used up getting into orbit. Wouldn't it have been safer and allowed the shuttle to be much lighter. If it were launched high up in the atmosphere, as on the back of a high-flying plane, or dropped from under one, like some of the early X-planes?
Well, it would have been safer, perhaps, but it could not have come anywhere near the size of the vehicle if they had tried to do that, and they could not have built in enough fuel to get it into orbit, because the big fuel requirement is to get the vehicle circling the Earth where it balances the gravity pull of Earth by the forward trajectory. And in order to do that, you just need a tremendous amount of thrust at some point. The smaller the vehicle, the easier it is to get that thrust. A big vehicle like Challenger, you've got to package somewhere an enormous amount of fuel. So again, it goes back to the size and the performance requirements. Building that huge vehicle, I mean, that thing is enormous, and it's extremely heavy. And once you decided to build something that big, and again, the reason they did so was to launch military satellites, you pretty much locked yourself into a situation where you've got tremendous safety problems in a manned space environment. People don't really understand when you go from an unmanned rocket to a manned system just what a tremendous burden you've created for yourself, not just in terms of safety, but in terms of the size and the weight of the safety systems.
Mm. Do you think that we have something better than the space shuttle but is being used by the military in a secret?
Well, there are rumors that that's so. There were plans going back into the Reagan administration days, maybe even earlier, to build a military space plane. I've heard, as I'm sure you have and other people, that such a space plane exists with a high-performance propulsion system, that it's even been used. I cannot verify that. I do not have personal knowledge of that. But that's what the rumors are.
If you had to decide whether the space shuttle was a practical craft for sending people and objects into orbit, what would your decision be?
Well, I think my decision, which of course is that of a layman, not a technical engineer, but the technical engineers who designed a smaller, safer shuttle back in the 1970s, and who were extremely disappointed when the choice was made to go with the enormous high-performance military-style vehicle, I think they were the ones who were right, and that should have been the decision at that time.
Mm. Is it true that a shuttle launch has a 1 in 200 chance of ending up in a disaster?
Well, that's pretty much been the statistics, maybe even a little bit more than that.
Do you think that it's possible that the Challenger disaster was caused by some outside force? There are stories circulating on the Internet that it might have been hit by a laser or sabotage was performed on it.
Yeah, I've seen all those reports. There's absolutely no data to support that, none whatsoever. It's just speculation, and anyone who puts forth a theory like that has got to come up with data.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one part of the commission's investigation that I think we can have confidence in. And if you read the technical reports, you can see that. And in fact, they pulled up off of the ocean bottom that section of the solid rocket booster that had been burned through. I characterize it in my book as big enough for a man to crawl through. It's just an enormous hole in the side of the solid rocket booster.
Mm.
And if you combine that with the photographs and the telemetry, that's what happened to Challenger. There was no external sabotage.
Now, does the shuttle have any advantages over a rocket?
Well, yes, it does. You know, the initial concept of a reusable vehicle that had multiple uses at low Earth orbit, for example, with the launching that they did of the Hubble Space Telescope and then the subsequent repairs that were done on the Space Telescope, I think it had a lot of potential, a lot of value that has been contributed and that potentially could have been contributed. But again, the shuttle as designed was so big, so sensitive, so complex, that just much more care should have been taken with it than NASA was able to do.
If I wanted to use the shuttle to send cargo into space, how much more expensive would it be by the pound than a conventional rocket?
Well, I don't know what the actual ratio is, but I expect that has been calculated. If you just remember that when you're sending a manned space vehicle into space, you've got to have all of the systems to protect human life. You've got to have the breathing system, the water system, the sewage system. You've got to have additional redundancy. You cannot accept any kind of a catastrophic accident if you're doing it properly. So you're going to have several times the cost added to a vehicle just because it's manned.
Did NASA really believe when they said, they were developing a reusable shuttle that it would allow us to put stuff and people into space more cheaply?
Well, the numbers that were generated were highly inflated, and I fault the Nixon administration for that. They had some studies done that I think were disingenuous studies. They were based upon made-up numbers, and when James Beggs came into office in around 1981 to begin to actually fly the shuttle, he hired a former Air Force managing officer named Robert Bowman to do a study of what actually could be expected of the shuttle, and I think that Bowman's figures were that the shuttle could launch maybe 25% of what was projected originally for a cost that was many times what the original projected cost was. I do believe that numbers were invented, or, you know, to be charitable, best case scenarios were selected in order to sell the shuttle to Congress.
Is the shuttle capable of being fitted with any weapons and used offensively or defensively?
The shuttle is not really a military weapons system as much as it was what I called a test platform. There was never any real intention to use the shuttle as a military attack weapon. What I wrote about and what I found to be the flaw in the system was that the shuttle was going to fly a lot of military missions where lasers, particle generators, and other types of weaponry were going to be tested. It was to be a test system or a test platform for the Strategic Defense Initiative, the so-called Star Wars program. Mm-hmm. But as experts pointed out, even at the time, the shuttle itself is so vulnerable. It has no defensive protection whatsoever, no capability of being loaded with any kind of serious weaponry, that it would never have been practical that the shuttle itself would have been a military weapon.
A few years ago, NASA talked about a recent discovery called aerogel. It's a substance that is extremely light, yet it supposedly makes a great heat shield. Have you ever heard about this?
No, actually I haven't.
Have you heard about the aerospike, which can form a protective shield around a craft by creating a detached shock wave ahead of the body?
Yes, I've heard about that. And if you think about the technology on the shuttle, it's extremely primitive. None of the systems today are really up to date. But if you even think further about the whole idea of putting human beings on the end of a enormous explosion, the way current rocket technology is used, you see that it's extremely dangerous, extremely primitive, and that we should get away from that as soon as we can. You have various experiments that are going on with anti-gravity, for example, and you have suggestions coming out that we could be seeing at some future date, maybe even a foreseeable date, rocketry that does not use explosive technology.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that's the way to go in the future.
Well, what do you think that NASA is continuing to use those heavy and troublesome tiles and foam on a shuttle and not using aerogel or the aerospike?
Well, I think a lot of it probably has to do with cost. You know, you've already The shuttle orbiters that have been in use for many years, you'd have to redesign the vehicle, and in order to do that, you would have to invest an enormous amount of money, and NASA has decided, rather than trying to improve a shuttle-type system, to abandon it and go back to the one-shot capsules that they're now developing in order to go back to the moon. It's a choice of priorities. What are your priorities? How much money do you have? What can you do? But think about the budget of NASA. The budget of NASA is approximately $16 billion a year. We're talking about expenditures on the Iraq war of right now approaching $1 trillion. That's where the United States is putting its priorities, not into the space program.
Well, as long as you brought the budget up, is it true that most of NASA's budget doesn't go for space exploration, but for the shuttle and the International Space Station?
Well, it's always been the case, and that's been one of the major controversies at NASA going way back into the 1970s. When the shuttle itself was proposed in the 1970s, the whole space science community was very strongly opposed to it. They did not want a space shuttle because they thought that the way the manned space program was being designed, it was going to take money that was needed away from all of the other unmanned exploratory ventures. And, of course, that's what has happened. Now, today, with the new Lunar Mars program, the new manned program that's been announced, the same thing is happening. Money is being taken away from all other NASA programs to the point where I'm told there are actual scientists in NASA who don't have work to do anymore because their projects have been taken away in order to fund the next phase of the manned space program. But this controversy between the enormous cost of manned space versus the relative low cost of unmanned space exploration, that's a controversy that's been going on in NASA for decades, and the decision has always been on the side of the manned space program, which of course is a much more spectacular and publicly visible program.
Was the shuttle rushed through the design stage just so we could get into space with a reusable vehicle?
Well, it was done as expeditiously as they could, even though it was the most expensive space vehicle ever designed. It took the longest to develop of any space vehicle ever designed. And there were numerous delays and numerous cost overruns before they finally launched it in 1981. So you can't really say it was rushed through, even though there were, given the complexity of the technology, there were shortcuts taken, certainly. But they took more time doing it than they ever had before because it was so complex and so expensive. But even by doing it, they cut corners.
Well, we call a space shuttle reusable, but the external tanks have to be prepared after they're picked up, and the shuttle has to be re-examined after every flight and repaired. Does this kind of thing cost more than just launching a rocket?
Oh, yes, way more. Yeah, it's extremely expensive, and the main reusability features are the orbiter itself. But that thing has to be refurbished every time there's a new launch, and that costs a lot of money and takes a lot of time. And then the solid rocket boosters themselves never achieved the level of reusability that they intended to because they were always losing flight segments for various reasons. But the reusability feature itself is a money saver in the long run, and that's the reason they designed it.
Tell us about the personal egress air packs, or PEAPs, that were aboard the shuttle and why three of them were found to have been used on the Challenger.
Well, the initial reports that came after the Challenger disaster from the NASA public relations officials were that the astronauts had all died in the explosion. Later, it was disclosed that this was not true. In fact, there was not really an explosion per se when Challenger broke up. It was a ignition of the external tank fuel, the hydrogen and liquid oxygen that created a fireball, but the vehicle itself did not explode from the inside, and so the crew cabin escaped intact and fell to the ocean surface. And during this fall, there's been a lot of speculation, although nothing definitive was ever released by NASA, as to whether the astronauts were still alive during the fall to the ocean surface, or whether they were even conscious. But the fact that it was discovered later that three of the air packs, the emergency air packs, were activated, it indicates that they were alive, some of them alive and conscious, during fall to the surface of the ocean. And the death very likely occurred from the impact with the surface of the ocean, or even, as some people have suggested, from drowning in the ocean. But the astronauts themselves were alive during the fall to the ocean floor.
Isn't it true that NASA had considered devices for crew escape during development, but felt that it was unnecessary due to the expected high reliability?
Well, that was the reason they gave, but I don't really believe that. They claimed that the shuttle would be so reliable as to preclude the need for any kind of crew escape. But NASA itself was running studies that showed a relatively high possibility of a catastrophic accident, even to the point of one study that predicted a 1 in 35 failure rate of the solid rocket boosters themselves. So I think it was more of a public relations or even a propaganda tool, because the real reason that they didn't put the escape systems in was cost and technical difficulty.
Mm-hmm. Didn't they consider escape devices after the Challenger disaster again and still didn't install any?
Well, they did consider them, and what they ended up doing was putting in place this pole system where the astronauts would slide down a pole that was stuck out of the crew cabin and then parachute down. Now, this could not be done during the early launch phase. This would be only during the phase where the astronauts would be in flight over the Atlantic Ocean, mm-hmm. During that one particular segment. But NASA rejected any options at that time for actual crew escape capsule or for the crew cabin to become detached.
At this point, we've been talking about an hour. I have about seven more questions. Would you be willing to
Sure.
Go? Okay, thanks. The New York Times complained that NASA wouldn't make anyone in the control room available to them for an interview the day after the Challenger disaster. Had you heard this, and what do you think the reason for this was?
Well, NASA went into a complete public relations lockdown. They confiscated physically the film and video that had been shot of the launch. They took that away from the news people who were there at the site. NASA knew they were in the control area at the Kennedy Space Center that afternoon, looking at videos of the launch, and they were seeing the signs of the rocket boosters, solid rocket boosters, with those flame leaks coming out of it that day. And the word went out immediately that nobody at NASA was to be talking about anything, anything that they had seen, anything that was going on. And they were putting out these press stories that, as far as they knew, there was no evident reason for the launch, and that they were going to launch a long-term investigation that maybe weeks and months later would begin to produce some kind of information. So there was a cover-up being put into place. At NASA headquarters, we were told not to talk to the press about anything.
How is it that private companies are developing space vehicles that only cost a few million dollars when NASA had to spend billions to accomplish this?
Well, the private space companies are not really doing much more than space tourism, which is where they're not even orbital flights, where you are shot up into space in a trajectory the way Alan Shepard did when he was the first U.S. Man in space. And so what the private companies are doing is pretty much replicating systems and technology that's 30 or 40 years old. it's not that hard to do anymore. Ariane, for example, the European Space Agency system has a tremendously positive launch rate by using very basic, very simple technology. So just arcing someone up above the atmosphere into what is called space, this day and age, is not that hard to do.
Mm. If you were the head of NASA, what changes would you make in the way that the funds are spent?
Well, that's a really good question. My own inclination is to focus much more on space science and on economic development of space. For example, the whole idea of using giant solar collectors in order to generate electricity in space, the idea of mining the astronauts, the asteroid belt or the moon. To me, these are much more promising. I think the whole idea of space colonization, sending a manned a trip to Mars, this sort of thing, I think this is pretty much public relations by NASA. I think a lot of it is to demonstrate a kind of military superiority that I don't really think is necessary. I think we should be working with other nations, with international cooperation, with Russia, with China, with the European Space Agency, to develop space science and space economic development a lot more than we are doing right now.
Do you believe that the huge sums of money that was supposedly spent on the X-33, a vehicle that was intended to replace the space shuttle but failed, were really spent on that project that could have been a front for something else?
Well, it's always possible. They speak of a black budget where the funding for various programs and agencies are diverted into secret projects. And I do expect this is going on, but I don't really have any firsthand information about that.
There's been a persistent rumor that NASA has a space station that is hidden from view. This has been cited in some books like Dark Mission by Hoagland and Barra. Do you think that this is true?
I have seen no solid information that it's true. This is, this type of speculation is interesting. I think that probably there are projects going on that are not known publicly, like, for instance, we mentioned earlier, the military space plane. But until you see some solid data on these sorts of things, or until you get an actual eyewitness who's a whistleblower and comes and tells you exactly what is going on, the speculation doesn't do a whole lot of good. Now, we do have some eyewitness commentary that has come out on the military space plane that I think is very interesting. But until you have this kind of testimony or scientific evidence, it's very difficult to just speculate about it.
By the end of 2010, our government will have spent over $174 billion on our space shuttles. Does this sound like we've lost our minds, or do you think that it is? Do you think that this is where all the money really went?
Well, I think that again, I don't know exactly where all of the money went. Those kinds of things are certainly grounds for speculation, particularly since you can't ever get a straight answer out of Congress because they're the ones who are supposed to have oversight. But, of course, they're all sworn to secrecy as well about things like this. But I do believe in the space program. I mean, I'm a very strong proponent of the U.S. space program, of man in space. I think that it's changed our consciousness of the world we live in, of the solar system, of the universe. I think it's been a tremendous technical and human achievement. I think that it has been a great stimulus to industry, to science and technology. So in general, I support the space program, but I support a space program that is in line with NASA's original objectives, which was a space program that is done in peace, that's done for the benefit of all mankind, is done for scientific and exploration purposes. I'm not in favor of any attempt by the United States or any other country to achieve space dominance or military dominance in space. And I think that discoveries that are made in the space program are ones that should be shared with people, with industry, with other nations, and used for the advancement of all people.
Is there anything that you'd like to add before we end the interview?
No, I greatly appreciate being able to talk to you. I think these are really important issues. They don't get a lot of play. I do have a new article coming out that's in Eurasia Critic magazine, mm-hmm. where I was asked, is there a new space race to the moon? And I say, yes, there certainly is.
Oh, yes, there is.
So people might want to take a look at that when it comes out, I believe, in the July issue. I think that the space program now, when you have other players coming onto the scene, like China, like India, you have a resurgent Russian space program, I think things could become very interesting, but I certainly do hope that it goes into peaceful directions and not just a military race for space dominance.
Don't we all? At this point, I'd like to thank you very much for such an interesting interview, and I wish you well in your future endeavors, and I believe that the American public owes you a debt of gratitude.